Only until they fill up, Cobb said. Those places are scant succor, anyhow. The men will beat each other over food and clothes once the guards lock them in, and they do worse to the women. Many prefer to risk the streets.
Why doesn't someone do something about it?
Arlen asked.
Everyone agrees it's a problem, Cobb said. But the citizens say it's the Duke's problem, and the Duke feels little need to protect those who contribute nothing to his city.
So better to send the guard home for the night and let the Corlings take care of the problem, Arlen growled.
Cobb had no reply, save to crack the reins, eager to get off the streets.
Two days later, the entire city was summoned to the great square. A gibbet had been erected, and upon it stood Warder Max, who had been on duty the night of the breach.
Euchre himself wasn't present, but Joan read his decree.
In the name of Duke Euchre, Light of the Mountains and Lord of Milne, you are found guilty of failing in your duties and allowing a breach in the ward wall. 8 warders, 2 messengers, 3 herb-gatherers, 37 guardsmen and 18 citizens paid the price for your incompetence.
As if making it 9 warders will help, Cobb muttered.
Boos and hisses came from the crowd, and bits of garbage were flung at the warder, who stood with his head down.
The sentence is death, Joan said, and hooded men took Mac's arms and led him to the rope, putting the noose around his neck. A tall, broad-shouldered tender with a bushy black beard and heavy robes went to him and drew a ward on his forehead.
May the Creator forgive your failing, the holy man intoned,
and grant us all the purity of heart and deed to end his plague and be delivered.
He backed away, and the trapdoor opened.
The crowd cheered as the rope went taut.
Fools, Cobb spat. One less man to fight the next breach.
What did he mean, Arlen asked, about the plague and being delivered?
Just nonsense to keep the crowd in line, Cobb said. Best not to fill your head with it.
Chapter 12 Library 321 AR
Arlen walked excitedly behind Cobb as they approached the great stone building. It was seventh day, and normally he would have been annoyed at skipping his spear practice and riding lessons, but today was a treat too fine to miss. His first trip to the Duke's library. Ever since he and Cobb had begun brokering wards, his master's business had soared, filling a much-needed niche in the city. Their grimoire library had quickly become the largest in Milne, and perhaps the world. At the same time, word had gotten out about their involvement in sealing the breach, and never once to miss a trend, the royals had taken notice. Royals were an irritation to work with, always making ridiculous demands and wanting wards put where they didn't belong. Cobb doubled, then tripled his prices, but it made no difference. Having one's manse sealed by Cobb, the wardmaster, had become a status symbol. But now, called upon to ward the most valuable building in the city, Arlen knew it had been worth every moment. Few citizens ever saw inside the library. Euchre guarded his collection jealously, granting access only to greater petitioners and their aides. Built by the tenders of the Creator before being absorbed by the throne, the library was always run by a tender, usually one with no flock save the precious books. Indeed, the post carried more weight than presiding over any holy house, save for the Grand Holy House or the Duke's own shrine. They were greeted by an acolyte and ushered to the office of the head librarian, Tender Ronald. Arlen's eyes darted everywhere as they walked, taking in the musty shelves and silent scholars who roamed the stacks. Not including grimoires, Cobb's collection had contained over 30 books, and Arlen had thought that a treasure. The Duke's library contained thousands, more than he could read in a lifetime. He hated that the Duke kept it all locked away. Tender Ronald was young for the coveted position of head librarian, still with more brown in his hair than gray. He greeted them warmly and sat them down, sending a servant to fetch some refreshment.
"Your reputation precedes you, Master Cobb,"
Ronald said, taking off his wire-rimmed glasses and cleaning them on his brown robe. "I hope you'll accept this assignment."
"All the words I've seen so far are still sharp," Cobb noted.
Ronald replaced his glasses and cleared his throat uncomfortably. "After the recent breach, the Duke fears for his collection," he said. "His Grace desires special measures."
"What kind of special measures?" Cobb asked suspiciously.
Ronald squirmed, and Arlen could tell that he was as uncomfortable making the request as he expected them to be in filling it. Finally, Ronald sighed. "All the tables, benches, and shelves are to be warded against fire spit," he said flatly. Cobb's eyes bulged.
"That would take months," he sputtered. "And to what end? Even if a flame demon made it so deep into the city, it could never get past the wards of this building. And if it did, you'd have greater worries than the bookshelves."
Ronald's eyes hardened at that. "There is no greater worry, Master Cobb," he said. "In that, the Duke and I agree. You cannot imagine what we lost when the Corlings burned the libraries of old. We guard here the last shreds of knowledge that took millennia to accumulate."
"I apologize," Cobb said. "I meant no disrespect."
The librarian nodded. "I understand, and you are quite correct. The risk is minimal. Nevertheless, His Grace wants what he wants. I can pay 1,000 gold suns. Arlen ticked the math off in his head. 1,000 suns was a lot of money, more than they had ever gotten for a single job. But when accounting for the months of work the job would entail, and the loss of regular business...
"I'm afraid I can't help you," Cobb said at last. "Too much time away from my business."
"This would garner the Duke's favor," Ronald added. Cobb shrugged.
"I messengered for his father. That brought me favor enough. I have little need for more. Try a younger warder," he suggested. "Someone with something to prove."
"His Grace mentioned your name specifically," Ronald pressed. Cobb spread his hands helplessly. "I'll do it," Arlen blurted. Both men turned to him, surprised that he had been so bold. "I don't think the Duke will accept the services of an apprentice," Ronald said. Arlen shrugged. "No need to tell him," he said. "My master can plot the wards for the shelves and tables, leaving me to inscribe them." He looked at Cobb as he spoke. "If you had taken the job, I would have carved half the wards anyway, if not more."
"An interesting compromise," Ronald said thoughtfully. "What say you, Master Cobb?"
Cobb looked at Arlen suspiciously.
"I say this is a tedious job of the sort you hate," he said.
"What's in it for you, lad?" he asked.
Arlen smiled. "The Duke gets to claim that Wardmaster Cobb warded the library," he began. "You get 1,000 suns, and I," he turned to Ronald, "get to use the library whenever I wish."
Ronald laughed. "A boy after my own heart," he said.
"Have we a deal?" he asked Cobb.
Cobb smiled, and the men shook hands. Tender Ronald led Cobb and Arlen on an inspection of the library. As they went, Arlen began to realize what a colossal task he had just undertaken. Even if he skipped the math and plotted the wards by sight, he was looking at the better part of a year's work. Still, as he turned in place, taking in all the books, he knew it was worth it. Ronald had promised him full access, day or night, for the rest of his life. Noting the look of enthusiasm on the boy's face, Ronald smiled. He had a sudden thought, and took Cobb aside while Arlen was too occupied with his own thoughts to notice. "Is the boy an apprentice or a servant?" he asked the warder.
"He's merchant, if that's what you're asking," Cobb said.
Ronald nodded.
"Who are his parents?"
Cobb shook his head.
"Hasn't any, at least not in Milne."
"You speak for him, then?" Ronald asked.
I would say the boy speaks for himself, Cobb replied.
Is he promised? The tender asked. There it was.
You're not the first to ask me that since my business rose, Cobb said. Even some of the royals have sent their pretty daughters to sniff at him. But I don't think the Creator has made the girl that can pull his nose out of a book long enough to notice her.
I know the feeling, Ronald said, gesturing to a young girl who was sitting at one of the many tables with half a dozen open books scattered before her. Mary, come here, he called.
The girl looked up and then deftly marked her pages and stacked her books before coming over. She looked close to Arlen's 14 summers, with large brown eyes and long, rich brown hair. She had a soft, round face and a bright smile. She wore a utilitarian frock, dusty from the library, and she gathered her skirts, dipping a quick curtsy. "Wardmaster Cobb, this is my daughter Mary," Ronald said. The girl looked up, suddenly very interested.
"The Wardmaster Cobb?" she asked.
"Ah, you know my work?" Cobb asked.
"No," Mary shook her head, "but I've heard your grimoire collection is second to none."
Cobb laughed.
"We might have something here, Tender," he said.
Tender Ronald bent to his daughter and pointed to Arlen.
"Young Arlen there is Master Cobb's apprentice. He's going to ward the library for us. Why don't you show him around?"
Mary watched Arlen as the boy gazed about, oblivious to her stare. His dirty blonde hair was untrimmed and somewhat long, and his expensive clothes were rumpled and stained. But there was intelligence in his eyes. His features were smooth and symmetrical, not unpleasing. Cobb heard Ronald mutter a prayer as she smoothed her skirts and glided over to him. Arlen didn't seem to notice Mary as she came over.
"Hello," she said.
"Hello," Arlen replied, squinting to read the print on the spine of a high-shelved book. Mary frowned.
"My name's Mary," she said. "Tender Ronald is my father."
"Arlen," Arlen said, pulling a book off the shelf and flipping through it slowly.
"My father asked me to show you around the library," Mary said.
"Thanks," Arlen said, putting the book back and walking down a row of shelves to a section of the library that was roped off from the rest. Mary was forced to follow, irritation flashing on her face.
"She's used to ignoring, not being ignored," Ronald noted, amused.
"B.R.," Arlen read on the archway over the roped section.
"What's B.R.?" he muttered. "Before return," Mary said. "Those are original copies of the books of the old world."
Arlen turned to her as if he had just noticed she existed.
"Honest word?" he asked.
"It's forbidden to go back there without the Duke's permission," Mary said, watching Arlen's face fall.
"Of course," she smiled, "I'm allowed, on account of my father."
"Your father?" Arlen asked.
"I'm Tender Ronald's daughter," she reminded, scowling.
Arlen's eyes widened, and he bowed awkwardly.
"Arlen, of Tibbetts Brook," he said.
From across the room, Cobb chuckled.
"Boy never had a chance," he said.
The months melted together for Arlen as he fell into a familiar routine. Reagan's manse was closer to the library, so he slept there most nights. The messenger's leg had mended quickly, and he was soon on the road again. Alyssa encouraged Arlen to treat the room as his own, and seemed to take a special pleasure in seeing it cluttered with his tools and books. The servants loved his presence as well, claiming Lady Alyssa was less of a trial when he was about. Arlen would rise an hour before the sun and practice his spear forms by lamplight in the manse's high-ceilinged foyer. When the sun broke the horizon, he slipped into the yard for an hour of target practice and riding. This was followed by a hurried breakfast with Alyssa, and Reagan when he was about, before he was off to the library. It was still early when he arrived, the library empty save for Ronald's acolytes, who slept in cells beneath the great building.
These kept their distance, intimidated by Arlen, who thought nothing of walking up to their master and speaking without summons or permission. There was a small isolated room designated as his workshop. It was just big enough for a pair of bookcases, his workbench, and whatever piece of furniture he was working on. One of the cases was filled with paints, brushes, and etching tools. The other was filled with borrowed books. The floor was covered in curled wood shavings, blotched from spilled paint and lacquer. Arlen took an hour each morning to read, then reluctantly put his book away and got to work. For weeks he warded nothing but chairs. Then he moved on to benches. The job took even longer than expected, but Arlen didn't mind. Mary became a welcome sight over these months, sticking her head into his workshop frequently to share a smile or a bit of gossip before scurrying off to resume her duties. Arlen had thought the interruptions from his work and study would grow tiresome, but the opposite proved true. He looked forward to seeing her, even finding his attention wandering on days when she didn't visit with her usual frequency. They shared lunches on the library's broad roof, overlooking the city and the mountains beyond. Mary was different from any girl Arlen had ever known. The daughter of the Duke's librarian and chief historian, she was possibly the most educated girl in the city. And Arlen found he could learn as much by talking to her as in the pages of any book. But her position was a lonely one. The acolytes were even more intimidated by her than they were by Arlen, and there was no one else her age in the library. Mary was perfectly comfortable arguing with gray-bearded scholars, but around Arlen she seemed shy and unsure of herself, much as he felt around her.
"Creator, Jake, it's as if you haven't practiced at all," Arlen said, covering his ears.
"Don't be cruel, Arlen," Mary scolded. "Your song was lovely, Jake," she said.
Jake frowned.
"Then why are you covering your ears, too?" he asked.
"Well," she said, taking her hands away with a bright smile,
"my father says music and dancing lead to sin, so I couldn't listen. But I'm sure it was very beautiful."
Arlen laughed, and Jake frowned, putting his lute away.
"Try your juggling," Mary suggested.
"Are you sure it's not a sin to watch juggling?" Jake asked.
"Only if it's good," Mary murmured, and Arlen laughed again.
Jake's lute was old and worn, never seeming to have all its strings at one time. He set it down and pulled colored wooden balls from the small sack he kept his jongleur equipment in. The paint was chipped, and there were cracks in the wood. He put one ball into the air, then another, and a third. He held that number for several seconds, and Mary clapped her hands.
"Much better," she said.
Jake smiled. "Watch this," he said, reaching for a fourth. Arlen and Mary both winced as the balls came clattering down to the cobblestones. Jake's face colored.
"Maybe I should practice more with three," he said.
"You should practice more," Arlen agreed.
"My dad doesn't like it," Jake said.
"He says if you've nothing to do but juggle, boy, I'll find some chores for you."
"My father does that when he catches me dancing," Mary said.
They looked at Arlen expectantly.
"My dad used to do that, too," he said.
"But not Master Cobb?" Jake asked. Arlen shook his head.
"Why should he? I do all he asks."
"Then when do you find time to practice messengering?" Jake asked.
"I make time," Arlen said.
"How?"
Jake asked.
Arlen shrugged.
"Get up earlier, stay up later, sneak away after meals, whatever you need to do. Or would you rather stay a miller your whole life?"
"There's nothing wrong with being a miller, Arlen," Mary said. Jake shook his head.
"Now he's right," he said. "If this is what I want, I have to work harder."
He looked at Arlen.
"I'll practice more," he promised.
"Don't worry," Arlen said. "If you can't entertain the villagers in the hamlets, you can earn your keep scaring off the demons on the road with your singing."
Jake's eyes narrowed.
Mary laughed as he began throwing his juggling balls at Arlen.
A good jongleur could hit me, Arlen taunted, nimbly dodging each throw. You're reaching too far, Cobb called. To illustrate his point, Reagan let go one hand from his shield and gripped Arlen's spear just below the tip before he could retract it. He yanked, and the overbalanced boy went crashing into the snow. Reagan, be careful, Alyssa admonished, clutching her shawl tightly in the chill morning air. You'll hurt him. He's far gentler than a Corling would be, my lady, Cobb said, loud enough for Arlen to hear. The purpose of the long spear is to hold the demons back at a distance while retreating. It's a defensive weapon. Messengers who get too aggressive with them, like young Arlen here, end up dead. I've seen it happen. There was one time on the road to Lacton. Arlen scowled. Cobb was a good teacher, but he tended to punctuate his lessons with grisly stories of the demise of other messengers. His intent was to discourage, but his words had the opposite effect, only strengthening Arlen's resolve to succeed where those before him failed. He picked himself up and set his feet more firmly this time, his weight on his heels. Enough with the long spears, Cobb said. Let's try the short ones. Alyssa frowned as Arlen placed the 8-foot-long spear on a rack, and he and Reagan selected shorter ones, barely 3 feet long, with points measuring a third of their length. They were designed for close-quarter fighting, stabbing instead of jabbing. He selected a shield as well, and the two of them once again faced off in the snow. Arlen was taller now, broader of the shoulder, 15 years old with a lean, wiry strength. He was dressed in Reagan's old leather armor. It was big on him, but he was fast growing into it. What's the point of this? Alyssa asked in exasperation. It's not like he's ever going to get that close to a demon and live to tell about it. I've seen it happen, Cobb disagreed as he watched Arlen and Reagan spar. But there are other things than demons out between the cities, m'lady. Wild animals, and even bandits. Who would attack a messenger? Alyssa asked, shocked. Reagan shot Cobb an angry look, but Cobb ignored him. Messengers are wealthy men, he said, and they carry valuable goods and messages that can decide the fate of merchants and royals alike. Most people wouldn't dare bring harm to one, but it can happen. And animals, with Corlings culling the weak, only the strongest predators remain. Arlen, the warder called. What do you do if you're attacked by a bear? Without stopping or taking his eyes off Reagan, Arlen called back, Long spear to the throat, retreat while it bleeds, then strike the vitals when it lowers its guard. What else can you do? Cobb called. Lie still, Arlen said distastefully. Bears seldom attack the dead. A lion, Cobb asked. Medium spear, Arlen called, picking off a stab from Reagan with his shield and countering. Stab to the shoulder joint and brace as the cat impales itself, then stab with a short spear to the chest or side as available. Wolf! I can't listen to any more of this, Alyssa said, storming off toward the manse. Arlen ignored her. A good whack to the snout with a medium spear will usually drive off a lone wolf, he said. Failing that, use the same tactics as for lions. What if there's a pack of them? Cobb asked. Wolves fear fire, Arlen said. And if you encounter a boar, Cobb wanted to know. Arlen laughed. I should run like all the corps is after me, he quoted his instructors. Arlen awoke atop a pile of books. For a moment, he wondered where he was, realizing finally that he had fallen asleep in the library again. He looked out the window, seeing that it was well past dark. He craned his head up, making out the ghostly shape of a wind demon as it passed far above. Alyssa would be upset. The histories he'd been reading were ancient, dating back to the age of science. They told of the kingdoms of the old world, Albanon, Thesa, Great Limb, and Rusk, and spoke of seas, enormous lakes spanning impossible distances, with yet more kingdoms on the far side,
It was staggering. If the books were to be believed, the world was bigger than he had ever imagined. He paged through the open book he had collapsed upon, and was surprised to find a map. As his eyes scanned the place names, they widened. There, plain as could be, was the Duchy of Milne. He looked closer and saw the river that Fort Milne used for much of its fresh water, and the mountains that stood at its back. Right there was a small star marking the capital. He flipped a few pages, reading about ancient Milne. Then, as now, it was a mining and quarrying city, with vassalage spanning dozens of miles. Duke Milne's territory included many towns and villages, ending at the Dividing River, the border of the lands held by Duke Angiers. Arlen remembered his own journey, and traced back west to the ruins he had found, learning that they had belonged to the Earl of Newkirk. Almost shaking with excitement, Arlen looked further and found what he'd been looking for. A small waterway opening into a wide pond. The Barony of Tibbet. Tibbet, Newkirk, and the others had paid tribute to Milne, who in turn, with Duke Angiers, owed fealty to the King of Thesa.
Thesans, Arlen whispered, trying the word on for size. We're all Thesans.
He took out a pen and began to copy the map. That name is not to be spoken again by either of you, Ronald scolded Arlen and his daughter.
But, Arlen began.
You think this wasn't known? The librarian cut him off. His Grace has ordered anyone speaking the name of Thesa arrested. Do you want to spend years breaking rocks in his mines?
Why? Arlen asked. What harm could it bring?
Before the Duke closed the library, Ronald said, some people were obsessed with Thesa, and with soliciting monies to hire messengers to contact lost dots on the maps.
What's wrong with that? Arlen asked.
The king is 3 centuries dead, Arlen, Ronald said, and the dukes will make war before they bend knee to anyone but themselves. Talk of reunification reminds people of things they ought not to remember.
Better to pretend that the walls of Milne are the entire world? Arlen asked.
Until the Creator forgives us and sends his deliverer to end the plague, Ronald said.
Forgives us for what? Arlen asked. What plague?
Ronald looked at Arlen, his eyes a mix of shock and indignation. For a moment, Arlen thought the tender might strike him. He steeled himself for the blow. Instead, Ronald turned to his daughter.
Can he really not know? He asked in disbelief.
Mary nodded. The tender in Tibbet's brook was unconventional, she said. Ronald nodded. I remember, he said. He was an acolyte whose master was Cord and never completed his training. We always meant to send someone new.
He strode to his desk and began penning a letter.
This cannot stand, he said. What plague indeed. He continued to grumble, and Arlen took it as a cue to edge for the door.
Not so fast, you two, Ronald said. I'm very disappointed in you both. I know Cobb isn't a religious man, Arlen, but this level of negligence is really quite unforgivable.
He looked to Mary. And you, young lady, he snapped.
You knew this and did nothing?
Mary looked at her feet.
I'm sorry, Father, she said.
And well you should be, Ronald said. He drew a thick volume from his desk and handed it to his daughter.
Teach him, he commanded, handing her the canon.
If Arlen doesn't know the book back and forth in a month, I'll take a strap to the both of you.
Mary took the book, and both of them scampered out as quickly as possible.
We got off pretty easy, Arlen said.
Too easy, Mary agreed. Father was right, I should have said something sooner.
Don't worry about it, Arlen said. It's just a book. I'll have it read by morning.
It's not just a book, Mary snapped.
Arlen looked at her curiously.
It's the word of the Creator as penned by the first deliverer, Mary said.
Arlen raised an eyebrow.
Honest word? He asked. Mary nodded.
It's not enough to read it. You have to live it, every day. It's a guide to bring humanity from the sin that brought about the plague.
What plague? Arlen asked for what felt like the dozenth time.
The demons, of course, Mary said. The callings.
Arlen sat on the library's roof a few days later, his eyes closed as he recited. And man again became prideful and bold, turning against creator and deliverer. He chose not to honor him who gave life, turning his back upon morality. Man's science became his new religion, replacing prayer with machine and chemic. Healing those meant to die, he thought himself equal to his maker. Brother fought brother to benefit none. Evil lacking without, it grew within, taking seed in the hearts and souls of men, blackening what was once pure and white. And so the Creator in his wisdom called down a plague upon his lost children, opening the core once again to show man the error of his ways. And so it shall be until the day he sends the Deliverer anew. For when the Deliverer cleanses man, callings will have naught to feed upon. And lo, ye shall know the Deliverer, for he shall be marked upon his bare flesh. And the demons will not abide the sight, and they shall flee terrified before him.
Very good, Mary congratulated with a smile.
Arlen frowned.
Can I ask you something? He asked.
Of course, Mary said.
Do you really believe that? He asked.
Tender Harrell always said the Deliverer was just a man. A great general, but a mortal man. Cobb and Reagan say so, too. Mary's eyes widened.
You'd best not let my father hear you say that, she warned.
Do you believe the callings are our own fault? Arlen asked. That we deserve them?
Of course I believe, she said. It's the word of the Creator.
No, Arlen said.
It's a book. Books are written by men. If the Creator wanted to tell us something, why would he use a book, and not write on the sky with fire?
It's hard sometimes to believe there's a Creator up there watching, Mary said, looking up at the sky.
But how could it be otherwise? The world didn't create itself. What power would wards hold without a will behind creation?
And the plague? Arlen asked.
Mary shrugged. The histories tell of terrible wars, she said. Maybe we did deserve it.
Deserve it? Arlen demanded. My mam didn't deserve to die because of some stupid war fought centuries ago.
Your mother was taken? Mary asked, touching his arm.
Arlen, I had no idea.
Arlen yanked his arm away.
It makes no difference, he said, storming toward the door. I have wards to carve. Though I hardly see the point, if we all deserve demons in our beds.
Chapter 13. There Must Be More. 326 AR.
Leisha bent in the garden, selecting the day's herbs. Some she pulled from the soil, root and stalk. Others she snapped off a few leaves, or used her thumbnail to pop a bud from its stem. She was proud of the garden behind Bruna's hut. The crone was too old for the work of maintaining the small plot, and Darcy had failed to make the hard dirt yield, but Leisha had the touch. Now many of the herbs that she and Bruna had once spent hours searching for in the wild grew just outside their door, safe within the ward posts.
"You've a sharp mind and a green thumb," Bruna had said when the soil birthed its first sprouts. "You'll be a better gatherer than I before long."
The pride those words gave Leisha was a new feeling. She might never match Bruna, but the old woman was not one for kind words or empty compliments. She saw something in Leisha that others hadn't, and the girl didn't want to disappoint.
Her basket filled, Leisha brushed off and rose to her feet, heading toward the hut, if it could even be called a hut anymore. Ernie had refused to see his daughter live in squalor, sending carpenters and roofers to shore up the weak walls and replace the frayed thatch. Soon there was little left that wasn't new, and additions had more than doubled the structure's size. Bruna had grumbled about all the noise as the men worked, but her wheezing had eased now that the cold and wet were sealed outside. With Leisha caring for her, the old woman seemed to be getting stronger with the passing years, not weaker. Leisha, too, was glad the work was completed. The men had begun looking at her differently toward the end. Time had given Leisha her mother's lush figure. It was something she had always wanted, but it seemed less an advantage now. The men in town watched her hungrily, and the rumors of her dallying with Garrod, though years gone, still sat in the back of many minds, making more than one man think she might be receptive to a lewd, whispered offer. Most of these were dissuaded with a frown, and a few with slaps. Evan had required a puff of pepper and stinkweed to remind him of his pregnant bride. A fistful of the blinding powder was now one of many things Leisha kept in the multitude of pockets in her apron and skirts. Of course, even if she had been interested in any of the men in town, Garrod made sure none could get close to her. Any man other than Ernie caught talking to Leisha about more than herb-gathering received a harsh reminder that in the burly woodcutter's mind she was still promised. Even Child Jonah broke out in a sweat whenever Leisha so much as greeted him. Her apprenticeship would be over soon. 7 years and a day had seemed an eternity when Bruna had said it, but the years had flown, and the end was but days away. Already, Leisha went alone each day to call upon those in town who needed an herb-gatherer's service, asking Bruna's advice only very rarely when the need was dire. Bruna needed her rest. The Duke judges an herb-gatherer's skill by whether more babies are delivered than people die each year, Bruna had said that first day. But focus on what's in between, and a year from now the people of Cutter's Hollow won't know how they ever got along without you. It had proven true enough. Bruna brought her everywhere from that moment on, ignoring the request of any for privacy. Her having cared for the unborn of most of the women in town, and brewed palm tea for half the rest, had them soon paying Leisha every courtesy, and revealing all the failings of their bodies to her without a thought. But for all that, she was still an outsider. The women talked as if she were invisible, blabbing every secret in the village as freely as if she were no more than a pillow in the night. "And so you are," Bruna said, when Leisha dared to complain. "It's not for you to judge their lives, only their health. When you put on that pocketed apron, you swear to hold your peace no matter what you hear. An herb-gatherer needs trust to do her work, and trust must be earned. No secret should ever pass your lips unless keeping it prevents you healing another." So Leisha held her tongue, and the women had come to trust her. Once the women were hers, the men soon followed, often with their women prodding at their back. But the apron kept them away all the same. Leisha knew what almost every man in the village looked like unclothed, but had never been intimate with one. And though the women might sing her praises and send her gifts, there wasn't a one she could tell her own secrets to. Yet despite all, Leisha had been far happier in the last 7 years than she had been in the 13 before. Bruna's world was much wider than the one she'd been groomed for by her mother. There was grief when she was forced to close someone's eyes, but there was also the joy of pulling a child from its mother and sparking its first cries with a firm swat. Soon her apprenticeship would be over, and Bruna would retire for good. To hear her speak it, she wouldn't live long after that. The thought terrified Leisha in more ways than one. Bruna was her shield and her spear, her impenetrable ward against the town. What would she do without that ward? Leisha didn't have it in her to dominate as Bruna had, barking orders and striking fools. And without Bruna, who would she have that spoke to her as a person and not an herb-gatherer? Who would weather her tears and witness her doubt?
For doubt was a breach of trust as well.
People depended on confidence from their herb gatherer. In her most private thoughts, there was even more. Cutter's Hollow seemed small to her now. The doors unlocked by Bruna's lessons weren't easily closed, a constant reminder not of what she knew, but of how much she didn't. Without Bruna, that journey would end. She entered the house, seeing Bruna at the table.
"Good morning," she said. "I didn't expect you up so early. I would have made tea before going into the garden."
She set her basket down and looked at the fire, seeing the steaming kettle near to boil.
"I'm old," Bruna grumbled, "but not so blind and crippled I can't make my own tea."
"Of course not," Leisha said, kissing the old woman's cheek. "You're fit enough to swing an axe alongside the cutters." She laughed at Bruna's grimace and fetched the meal for porridge. The years together hadn't softened Bruna's tone, but Leisha seldom noticed it now, hearing only the affection behind the old woman's grumbling and responding in kind.
"You're out gathering early today," Bruna noted as they ate. "You can still smell the demon stink in the air."
"Only you could be surrounded with fresh flowers and complain of the stink," Leisha replied. Indeed, she kept blooms throughout the hut, filling the air with sweetness.
"Don't change the subject," Bruna said.
"A messenger came last night," Leisha said. "I heard the horn."
"Not a moment before sundown, too," Bruna grunted.
"Reckless." She spat on the floor.
"Bruna," Leisha scolded. "What have I told you about spitting inside the house?"
The crone looked at her, rheumy eyes narrowing.
"You told me this is my ripping home and I can spit where I please," she said.
Leisha frowned.
"I was sure I said something else," she mused.
"Not if you're smarter than your bosom makes people think," Bruna said, sipping her tea.
Leisha let her jaw drop in mock indignation, but she was used to far worse from the old woman. Bruna did and said as she pleased, and no one could tell her differently.
"So it's the messenger that has you up and about so early," Bruna said. "Hoping it's the handsome one, what's his name, the one that makes puppy eyes at you?"
Leisha smiled wryly.
"More like wolf eyes," she said.
"That can be good too," the old woman cackled, slapping Leisha's knee.
Leisha shook her head and rose to clear the table.
"What's his name?" Bruna pressed.
"It's not like that," Leisha said.
"I'm too old for this dance, girl," Bruna said. "Name?"
"Marek," Leisha said, rolling her eyes.
"Shall I brew a pot of palm tea for young Marek's visit?" Bruna asked.
"Is that all anyone thinks about?" Leisha asked. "I like talking to him, that's all."
"I'm not so blind I can't say that boy has more in his mind than talk," Bruna said.
"Oh?" Leisha asked, crossing her arms. "How many fingers am I holding up?"
Bruna snorted.
"Not a one," she said, not even turning Leisha's way. "I've been around long enough to know that trick," she said. "Just as I know Maverick the Messenger hasn't made eye contact with you once in all your talks."
"His name is Marek," Leisha said again. "And he does too."
"Only if he doesn't have a clear view of your neckline," the crone said.
"You're impossible," Leisha huffed.
"No cause for shame," Bruna said. "If I had paps like yours, I'd flaunt them too."
"I do not flaunt,"
Leisha shouted, but Bruna only cackled again.
A horn sounded not far off.
"That'll be young Master Marek," Bruna advised. "You'd best hurry and primp."
"It's not like that," Leisha said again,
but Bruna dismissed her with a wave.
"I'll put that tea on just in case," she said.
Leisha threw a rag at the old woman and stuck out her tongue, moving toward the door. Outside on the porch, she smiled in spite of herself as she waited for the messenger. Bruna pushed her to find a man nearly as much as her mother did. But the crone did it out of love. She wanted only for Leisha to be happy, and Leisha loved her dearly for it. But despite the old woman's teasing, Leisha was more interested in the letters Marek carried than his wolf eyes. Ever since she was young, she had loved messenger days. Cutter's Hollow was a little place, but it was on the road between three major cities and a dozen hamlets, and between the Hollow's timber and Ernie's paper, it was a strong part of the region's economy. Messengers visited the Hollow at least twice a month, and while most mail was left with Smit, they delivered to Ernie and Bruna personally, frequently waiting for replies. Bruna corresponded with gatherers in Forts Risen and Angiers, Lacton, and several hamlets. As the crone's eyesight failed, the task of reading the letters and penning Bruna's replies fell to Leisha. Even from afar, Bruna commanded respect. Indeed, most of the herb gatherers in the area had been students of hers at one time or another. Her advice was frequently sought to cure ailments beyond others' experience, and offers to send her apprentices came with every messenger. No one wished for her knowledge to pass from the world. "I'm too old to break in another novice," Bruna would grouse, waving her hand dismissively. And Leisha would pen a polite refusal, something she had gotten quite used to. All this gave Leisha many opportunities to talk with messengers. Most of them leered at her, it was true, or tried to impress her with tales of the free cities. Marek was one of those. But the messengers' tales struck a chord with Leisha. Their intent might have been to charm their way into her skirts, but the pictures their words painted stayed with her in her dreams. She longed to walk the docks of Lacton, see the great warded fields of Fort Risen, or catch a glimpse of Angiers, the forest fortress, to read their books and meet their herb-gatherers. There were other guardians of knowledge of the old world if she dared seek them out. She smiled as Marek came into view. Even a ways off, she knew his gait, legs slightly bowed from a life spent on horseback. The messenger was Angerian, barely as tall as Leisha, at 5'7", but there was a lean hardness about him, and Leisha hadn't exaggerated about his wolf eyes. They roved with predatory calm, searching for threats and prey. "Aye, Leisha," he called, lifting his spear toward her. Leisha lifted her hand in greeting. "Do you really need to carry that thing in broad day?" she called, indicating the spear. "What if there was a wolf?" Marek replied with a grin. "How would I defend you?" "We don't see a lot of wolves in Cutter's Hollow," Leisha said as he drew close. He had longish brown hair and the eyes the color of tree bark. She couldn't deny that he was handsome. "A bear, then," Marek said as he reached the hut. "Or a lion. There are many kinds of predators in the world," he said, eyeing her cleavage. "Of that I am well aware," Leisha said, adjusting her shawl to cover the exposed flesh. Marek laughed, easing his messenger bag down onto the porch. "Shawls have gone out of style," he advised. "None of the women in Angiers or Risen wear them anymore." "Then I'll wager their dresses have higher necks or their men more subtlety," Leisha replied. "High necks," Marek agreed with a laugh, bowing low. "I could bring you a high-necked Angerian dress," he whispered, drawing close. "When would I ever have cause to wear that?" Leisha asked, slipping away before the man could corner her. "Come to Angiers," the messenger offered. "Wear it there." Leisha sighed. "I would like that," she lamented. "Perhaps you'll get the chance," the messenger said slyly, bowing and sweeping his arm to indicate that Leisha should enter the hut before him. Leisha smiled and went in, but she felt his eyes on her backside as she did. Bruna was back in her chair when they entered. Marek went to her and bowed low. "Young Master Marek," Bruna said brightly. "What a pleasant surprise." "I bring you greetings from Mistress Giselle of Angiers," Marek said. "She begs your aid in a troubling case." He reached into his bag and produced a roll of paper tied with stout string. Bruna motioned Felicia to take the letter and sat back, closing her eyes as her apprentice began to read.
"Honored Bruna, greetings from Fort Angiers in the year 326 AR," Leisha began.
"Giselle yapped like a dog when she was my apprentice, and she writes the same way,"
Bruna cut her off.
"I won't live forever. Skip to the case."
Leisha scanned the page, flipping it over and looking over the back as well. She was onto the second sheet before she found what she was looking for. "A boy," Leisha said, 10 years old, brought into the hospital by his mother, complaining of nausea and weakness. No other symptoms or history of illness. Given grim root, water, and bed rest. Symptoms increased over 3 days with the addition of rash on arms, legs, and chest. Grimroot raised to 3 ounces over the course of several days. Symptoms worsened, adding fever and hard white boils growing out of the rash. Salves had no effect. Vomiting followed. Given heart leaf and poppy for the pain, soft milk for the stomach. No appetite, doesn't appear to be contagious. Bruna sat a long while, digesting the words. She looked at Marek.
"Have you seen the boy?" she asked.
The messenger nodded.
"Was he sweating?" Bruna asked.
"He was," Marek confirmed, "but shivering, too, like he was both hot and cold." Bruna grunted.
"What color were his fingernails?" she asked.
"Fingernail color," Marek replied with a grin.
"Get smart with me and you'll regret it," Bruna warned.
Marek blanched and nodded. The old woman questioned him for a few minutes more, grunting occasionally at his responses. Messengers were known for their sharp memories and keen observation, and Bruna didn't seem to doubt him. Finally, she waved him into silence.
"Anything else of note in the letter?" she asked.
"She wants to send you another apprentice," Leisha said. Bruna scowled. "I have an apprentice, Vika, who's almost completed her training," Leisha read. "As your letters tell, do you. If you're not willing to accept a novice, please consider an exchange of adepts." Leisha gasped, and Marek broke into a knowing grin.
"I didn't tell you to stop reading," Bruna rasped.
Leisha cleared her throat. "Vika is most promising," she read, "and well-equipped to see to the needs of Cutter's Hollow, as well as look after and learn from wise Bruna. Surely Leisha, too, could learn much ministering to the sick in my hospit. Please, I beg, let at least one more benefit from wise Bruna before she passes from this world." Bruna was quiet a long while.
"I'll think on this a while before I reply," she said at last. "Go to your rounds in town, girl. We'll speak on this when you return."
To Marek, she said,
"You'll have a response tomorrow. Leisha will see to your payment."
The messenger bowed and backed out of the house as Bruna sat back and closed her eyes. Leisha could feel her heart racing, but she knew better than to interrupt the crone as she sifted through the many decades of her memory for a way to treat the boy. She collected her basket and left to make her rounds. Marek was waiting for her when Leisha came outside.
"You knew what was in that letter all along," Leisha accused.
"Of course," Marek agreed.
"I was there when she penned it."
"But you said nothing,"
Leisha said. Marek grinned.
"I offered you a high-necked dress," he said, "and that offer still stands."
"We'll see."
Leisha smiled, holding out a pouch of coins.
"Your payment," she said.
"I'd rather you pay me with a kiss," he said.
"You flatter me.
To say my kisses are worth more than gold," Leisha replied.
"I fear to disappoint."
Marek laughed.
"My dear, if I braved the demons of the night all the way from Angiers and back and returned with but a kiss from you, I would be the envy of every messenger ever to pass through Cutter's Hollow."
"Well, in that case," Leisha said with a laugh, "I think I'll keep my kisses a little longer, in hopes of a better price."
"You cut me to the quick," Marek said, clutching his heart.
Leisha tossed him the pouch, and he caught it deftly.
"May I at least have the honor of escorting the herb-gatherer into town?" he asked with a smile. He made a leg and held out his arm for her to take.
Misha smiled in spite of herself.
"You don't do things so quickly in the hollow," she said, eyeing the arm. "But you may carry my basket."
She hooked it on his outstretched arm and headed toward town, leaving him staring after her. Smith's Market was bustling by the time they reached town. Leisha liked to select early before the best produce was gone, and place her order with Doug the butcher before making her rounds.
"Good morn, Leisha," said Jan Gray, the oldest man in Cutter's Hollow. His gray beard, a point of pride, was longer than most women's hair. Once a burly cutter, Jan had lost most of his bulk in his latter years, and now leaned heavily on his cane.
"Good morn, Jan," she replied. "How are the joints?"
"Pain me still," Jan replied. "Especially the hands. Can barely hold my cane some days."
"Yet you find it in you to pinch me whenever I turn round," Leisha noted.
Jan cackled.
"To an old man like me, girlie, that's worth any pain."
Leisha reached into her basket, pulling forth a small jar.
"It's well that I made you more sweet salve, then," she said. "You've saved me the need to bring it by."
Jan grinned.
"You're always welcome to come by and help apply," he said, with a wink.
Leisha tried not to laugh, but it was a futile effort. Jan was a lecher, but she liked him well enough. Living with Bruna had taught her that the eccentricities of age were a small price to pay for having a lifetime of experience to draw upon.
"You'll just have to manage yourself, I'm afraid," she said.
"Bah!"
Jan waved his cane in mock irritation.
"Well, you think on it," he said.
He looked to Merrick before taking his leave, giving a nod of respect.
"Messenger."
Merrick nodded back, and the old man moved off. Everyone at the market had a kind word of greeting for Leisha, and she stopped to ask after the health of each, always working, even while shopping. Though she and Bruna had plenty of money from selling flame sticks and the like, no one would take so much as a clat in return for her selections. Bruna asked no money for healing, and no one asked money of her for anything else. Merrick stood protectively close as she squeezed fruit and vegetables with a practiced hand. He drew stares, but Leisha thought it was as much because he was with her than it was the presence of a stranger at market. Messengers were common enough in Cutter's Hollow. She caught the eye of Keat, Stephanie's son, if not Smith's. The boy was nearly 11 and looked more and more like tender Michelle with each passing day. Stephanie had kept her side of the bargain over the years and not spoken ill of Leisha since she was apprenticed. Her secret was safe as far as Bruno was concerned, but for the life of her, Leisha couldn't see how Smith failed to see the truth staring at him from the supper table each night. She beckoned, and Keat came running. "Bring this bag to Bruno once your chores allow," she said, handing him her selections. She smiled at him and secretly pressed a clat into his hand. Keat grinned widely at the gift. Adults would never take money from an herb gatherer, but Leisha always slipped children something for extra service. The lacquered wooden coin from Angiers was the main currency in Cutter's Hollow, and would buy Risonian sweets for Keat and his siblings when the next messenger came. She was ready to leave when she saw Mary and moved to greet her. Her friend had been busy over the years. Three children clung to her skirts now. A young glassblower named Ben had left Angiers to find his fortune in Lacton or Fort Risen. He'd stopped in the hollow to ply his trade and raise a few more clats before the next leg of the journey, but then he met Mary, and those plans dissolved like sugar in tea. Now Ben plied his trade in Mary's father's barn, and business was brisk. He bought bags of sand from messengers out of Fort Crasia, and turned them into things of both function and beauty. The hollow had never had a blower before, and everyone wanted glass of their own. Leisha, too, was pleased by the development, and soon had Ben making the delicate components of distilleries shown in Bruna's books, allowing her to leach the strength from herbs and brew cures far more powerful than the hollow had ever seen. Soon after, Ben and Mary wed, and before long, Leisha was pulling their first child from between Mary's legs. Two more had followed in short order.